Hi, so for those of you who don't know me, I'm Stan Goldberg. I'm one of the GI attendings. Today we're going to talk about inflammatory bowel disease. I'm going to spend a good amount of time talking a little bit about epidemiology, distinguishing among the more common variants of inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's and UC, trying to make sure that you're comfortable trying to differentiate those from other conditions that could present similarly. I know that as of at least recently, we're now posting some of these slides so that they're available on the website. I have a whole bunch of slides on therapy that I really don't anticipate getting to, but if there are questions at the end, I'll certainly be happy to hang around for that. So again, just as a broad definition to begin with, because this will come into play when we talk about sort of proposed etiologies and mechanisms and why some people seem to be predisposed to this. But when we talk about idiopathic inflammatory bowel disease, we're basically referring to a chronic, often relapsing disease for which a cause is not necessarily known. But I'll make the point just even at the very beginning. It basically results from a dysregulation of the mucosal immune response. And I usually make this point later on. I may make it again. But the point being, just recognize that, in general, the body responds to non-self with inflammation. Right, so if you get exposed to a virus, if you have chickenpox, etc., the reason you respond is that your immune system is responding. What's somewhat phenomenal about the mucosal immune system is that it's recognizing antigen or non-self all the time and somehow has a response to something that's referred to as tolerance, so that if anything, the normal tone of the mucosal immune system is suppressive. So in general, it's somewhat remarkable that we don't have more inflammatory bowel disease, or that we don't mount more mucosal inflammation in response to non-self. But what classifies these diseases is that you have inappropriate activation of the mucosal immune response, and it's clear that it involves environmental factors, that there is a role to the normal flora, to the normal luminal bacteria, and that there is some genetic susceptibility. So again, the broad category of what's probably better referred to as inflammatory bowel diseases. We will spend the majority of our time talking about the two on the left, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. But bear in mind that when we talk about some of these idiopathic or unclear cause inflammatory bowel diseases, there are a whole host of other colitides, microscopic, lymphocytic, and collagenous colitis, which may be a spectrum of the same disease, which is not part of what we're focusing on today. Diversion colitis, which occurs in people usually after they've had an ostomy and part of their bowel bypassed, and some of the other colitides mentioned there. But we will spend some time both differentiating what the clinical course is and how one differentiates ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. And again, I think that it's still somewhat unclear as to whether inflammatory bowel disease is one big basket of abnormalities of mucosal immunity that can have various clinical expressions, or whether each of these are distinct and separate diseases. Some people classify this as whether you're a lumper or a splitter, whether you call it all inflammatory bowel disease or whether you differentiate it. Among those who are splitters, it actually seems that not only is Crohn's disease distinct and separate but also from ulcerative colitis, but that clinical patterns in Crohn's disease may actually be somewhat different, that people who tend to have an inflammatory course as opposed to an obstructive or a fibrous stenotic course, that those are things that seem to have some familiar predisposition, and may actually be somewhat different diseases per se. How many of you, just by a show of hands, were at Dr. Brandt's grand rounds on Friday? Okay, so because some of this will come up again. So he mentioned something about a flaw with some of the older series on ischemic colitis, and the fact that a lot of these were retrospective, that they probably weren't all ischemia. And I think he said that we've gotten a lot better with that over the last decade, maybe 15 years. And this is probably another example of that. This is data that's long quoted, but from the early 70s. It's basically mostly here to point out that ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease are diseases that occur fairly equally among gender, among men and women, that they're diseases primarily of younger people, primarily in the 20s and 30s. As I'll show you in a slide or two, at this point, it did seem to be that, at least in the U.S. population, that ulcerative colitis was more common than Crohn's disease, although that's probably no longer true. But the other point was that it's often been quoted that these are diseases that occur more commonly in the 20s or 30s, but that there's sort of like this bimodal second peak of Crohn's disease that's especially been described more in women than men in their 60s and early 70s. And I think that today most of us believe that that's probably ischemic colitis and not really Crohn's disease. And I think that Dr. Brandt made the point that you should be wary of making a new diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease in people in their 60s and 70s, and I would echo that point. But this is, again, something that we've seen over the course of decades, and it's interesting, but, both inflammatory bowel disease as a whole tends to be more common in industrialized countries, and when you start seeing an increase in the incidence of inflammatory bowel disease, it seems for unclear reasons, maybe predisposed to environmental factors, but that ulcerative colitis tends to peak about a generation earlier than Crohn's disease, but then over time you usually get some evening of the distribution of UC and Crohn's. And so here, if you take a look at the area around the Mayo Clinic going back to the 1940s, the incidence prevalence was approximately 1 to 2 per 100,000, gradually increased over a period of 20 to 30 years, with Crohn's somewhat lagging behind, but now, and this is sort of maintained over the last decade or so, the incidence is fairly equal of these two diseases. And I said that for reasons that clearly have to do with the risk factors and not well understood pathogenesis, there does seem to be the global prevalence of inflammatory bowel disease is almost a mirror image of infectious diarrhea. So what you do is you find the highest incidence among North America, Western Europe, you find intermediate area sort of in parts of South Africa, Israel in the middle over here, parts of Asia, Japan, Korea, and lower incidences in South America, parts of Africa, where you have a higher incidence of infectious diarrhea. And so it does seem to be that that the risk factors for IBD seem to be somewhat inverse to the risk factors for infectious diarrhea, and that there have been proposals of how higher sanitary conditions, modern plumbing, may actually cause impact on either mucosal flora, other interaction of luminal bacteria and environmental risks that may predispose to developing IBD. And the other thing that's sort of interesting to note about the epidemiology, because it's something that's seen both in Europe as well as in the United States, is that there does seem to be a north-south gradient. The incidence in the northern United States, the area around, let's say, the Mayo Clinic compared to areas in the southeast, show that there's a higher incidence in northern latitudes or longitudes. Latitudes? Okay, thank you. And in Europe, you see the same thing in the Scandinavian countries compared to Germany and Italy. And again, whether this has to do with bacteria that exist at certain environments, certain temperatures, certain climates, and whether it's those luminal bacteria that may be either more pro-inflammatory or somewhat protective, but this does pan out, certainly among, as I said, the United States and Europe, that there does seem to be a higher incidence in northern latitudes. So again, we talked briefly about the environmental risks, and we did discuss or mention whether they're really a spectrum of one disease or different diseases. Well, certainly if you take a look at some of the environmental risk factors, it does appear as though they're somewhat different. It's known that for reasons that aren't particularly clear, that patients who smoke have a lower incidence of ulcerative colitis. It's actually been not necessarily smoking, but people have looked at nicotine patches as a therapy for active ulcerative colitis with mixed results. Whereas inversely, patients who smoke have a higher likelihood of developing Crohn's disease. More so, while they're actively smoking, they're more likely to have flares. And active smokers are probably more resistant to certain therapies for Crohn's disease, especially anti-inflammatories and TNF inhibitors. So certainly looking at the incidence and the epidemiology of smoking, it does seem, as though there is something distinct. Furthermore, it's just been noted in large population cross-sections that patients who have appendectomy seem to have a lower incidence over the course of years of developing ulcerative colitis. No one is proposing that we do prophylactic appendectomy to prevent UC. Nobody is suggesting that that would have a role, but for people who have appendectomies for appendicitis, they seem to have a significantly lower risk of developing ulcerative colitis over the course of their lifetime. Again, high sanitation levels seem to be positively correlated with Crohn's disease. That may fit into some of the data that we talked about how one recognizes and develops their mucosal immune system and learns to sort of regulate and downregulate inflammation. And again, a lot of these things sort of have weak associations, but I guess the only thing worth noting is that there, whatever association there is or isn't is different between UC and Crohn's. Again, I always make this point whenever I give this talk, but you know, colitis is a very generic term, right? Colitis basically means inflammation of the colon, and there are a whole host of entities that can predispose the colon to colitis. I like to sort of say that, you know, as intelligent as I'd like to think the GI tract is, that there really is a limited number of ways that the GI tract can respond to insult, and usually it's done with inflammation. That said, while it may be difficult to some extent clinically and even endoscopically, when you have biopsy and culture and other things, it's often possible to differentiate among these whole host of issues that that can lead to inflammation. So certainly we're talking about IBD. You know, radiation is classic for people who have pelvic radiation, either for prostate cancer, cervical cancer, and it has a somewhat different pattern. Again, I know Dr. Brandt discussed at length ischemia of the colon and a whole host of other causes that can give you colonic inflammation. So the hallmark of ulcerative colitis and the thing that, I hopefully by the end of this we'll discuss some of the crossover, but, you know, it'll reach a point that if you see a patient with a certain clinical syndrome, you may have difficulty differentiating on acute presentation IBD from non-IBD, but for the overall majority of patients, it shouldn't be all that difficult to differentiate Crohn's disease from ulcerative colitis. So one of the things that's classic about ulcerative colitis is that it's a disease that only affects the colon, doesn't affect any other part of the GI tract. It's a disease that only affects the mucosa. So when we differentiate it, we'll talk about some of the complications and findings that we see in Crohn's that really aren't part of the description of what we see in ulcerative colitis. Classically, it has a continuous distribution, so it starts right at the anorectal junction. And again, it may only involve a small portion of the colon, it may involve the entire colon, but wherever it is, it's usually a segment and then an abrupt transition. And again, almost always it has rectal involvement, and so therefore, almost always it has rectal bleeding as a hallmark symptom. And as I said, we can differentiate how we define it and describe it by the extent of the disease. Just proctitis is only obviously in the rectum, proctosigmoiditis, and the rest is, I think, pretty self-evident. And here's a nice example of a colectomy specimen. Again, so this is a colon that's sort of resected, laid out, cut open, so that basically, you know, it would be a cylinder if you sort of attach this end to that end. But this is cut open and laid flat on the table, and you can sort of see anorectal junction, you know, inflamed. And right here you have an abrupt transition between involved and uninvolved colon. And this is a very dramatic example, but also, you know, a classic example of what this transition zone looks like. So again, we can differentiate it based on the extent of involvement in terms of the how much of the colon is involved. We can also describe it or define it based on how severe the inflammation is. So in, you know, normally if we do a colonoscopy, we can sort of see, you know, the folds, not, again, they're not circumferential folds, these are haustra, but we can sort of see a nice pale columnar mucosa, and you can see these nice submucosal capillaries that are running here, branching along, and you can make them out fairly distinctly, and this is a normal appearing colon. When we describe, you know, degree of inflammation, so the lighting is not great, but up over here, this section here is pretty similar to this. This is relatively normal, but this area here, you can see this redness, you can see these white spots, which is basically what we would call a granular pattern. It has to do with mucosal edema, and the way that it reflects light from an endoscope, it causes some scattering that gives us this sort of, again, it we would describe it as granular or nodular, but it's really just a manifestation of some mild local edema. Again, you can sort of see that this is more enhanced here. The light's even more irregular. You see more of these white spots that are probably erosion. And then you have this area here with this white is all, you know, exudate, inflammation, ulcer, and this is fairly severe colitis. And often, even if people are asymptomatic and we're doing procedures down the road, there is the inflammation, regeneration, and repair mechanism does lead to some chronic changes. We can certainly appreciate some of these histologically, but even on gross appearance, you'll often have some irregularity of these vessels, some, you know, irregular branching, and also like these small pseudopolyps over here. This is only one example of that there, but this is often what we see in a non-active or burnt-out colitis. again, I'll use this point because I know it comes up. It certainly comes up when we review this with the second-year medical students, but it even comes up with our fellows in terms of differentiating when you read a histology report, when people have colonic biopsies, and we see all the time people come in, they have some sort of a colitis, they have a flexible sigmoidoscopy or a colonoscopy, and you look at the result and they describe cryptitis and cryptabscesses. And I would think that that's a term that most of you have come across, and for some unknown reason, in a lot of people's mind, when they hear cryptitis and cryptabscess, they automatically think inflammatory bowel disease. And I think that the, you know, one of the take-home points is that I'd like you to understand that that's not true. Again, these are just definitions. Cryptitis is basically, you know, when you have white cells eating away at a crypt, and it's usually an acute inflammatory infiltrate. And a crypt abscess is sort of when you have, you know, a nice linear crypt over here, and you have sort of all these inflammatory cells and exudate and basically pus in the middle of a crypt. And while one can see that in an acute exacerbation of inflammatory bowel disease, it's also a hallmark of any infectious or acute colitis. So those terms should not necessarily make you think of a chronic process, nor should they really make you think that it's, you know, IBD as opposed to infection. What really helps distinguish and differentiate IBD histologically is some of the chronic changes. And, you know, here you can sort of see some branching and irregularity of the crypts. You're seeing a little bit of fibrosis in the submucosal layer. And I think the next slide sort of compares and contrasts. But so as opposed to the acute inflammatory response, where you have a nice linear array of crypts and inflammation, when you have IBD, you often get an increased basophilic staining. You have somewhat irregular nuclei, but you also have these very irregular, very branched crypts that is really a hallmark of chronic as opposed to acute disease. And since most of the acute colitides that we talked about in that list are really more acute self-limited processes, again, things like ischemic colitis, which is usually acute and self-limited, infectious, etc., one of the things that helps differentiate IBD from acute colitis is finding some of these signs of chronicity, even with the first clinical expression, with the first presentation. So again, just to make the point again about the hallmarks of ulcerative colitis to help us compare and contrast and differentiate it from Crohn's disease. And so again, the first thing to help us, you know, think about and differentiate when we're evaluating a patient, and obviously it's a lot easier once you have more studies and more information, but whereas ulcerative colitis affects only the colon, the majority of people, up to 80% or so of people with Crohn's disease will have some involvement of the small bowel. So in about a third of patients, they'll present only with small bowel disease. Almost half of patients will have disease primarily of the terminal ileum and part of the colon. And it's only about 20% of patients that have only colonic involvement that might even be part of the differential of comparing Crohn's to UC. And really, one of the important differentiating features and what really leads to a lot of the morbidity and unique manifestations of Crohn's disease is the concept of transmural inflammation. So if this is the mucosal layer and this is sort of the basement membrane running over here, we define ulcerative colitis as being a mucosal disease. It basically only affects this layer, and that's why almost all the manifestations relate to diarrhea, bleeding, etc. Whereas the hallmark of the inflammation in Crohn's disease is that it's really this transmural inflammation, which helps you understand how you can get inflammation and a response that goes all the way through the muscular layer into the serosa. But there are plenty of seats up front, by the way, if anybody wants to come in and have a seat. It helps one understand how one loop of bowel that's inflamed all the way through to its serosa can abut against another loop of bowel and cause some of the more common and debilitating manifestations that we see. So certainly those that relate to the transmural inflammation that are somewhat unique to Crohn's and are much less common, if not unheard of, in ulcerative colitis, is stricturing. Again, if you have only mucosal involvement, you know, you really, you know, should not have narrowing, whereas if you have transmural inflammation and you have that in a circumferential way, over time it can clamp down and scar and stricture. I think that the rule of thumb is that, you know, strictures in Crohn's disease are common and part of the process. A stricture in ulcerative colitis is malignancy until proven otherwise. Again, the concept of fistulization, you know, it's somewhat interesting that while it can happen in unusual circumstances. It's somewhat rare for patients with Crohn's disease to present with peritonitis and free perforation. What often happens is that in relation to this transmural inflammation, they sort of have one loop of bowel that sort of abuts and sticks to another loop of bowel, and the inflammation can basically erode through, causing fistulization. So again, another manifestation which is essentially not part of the spectrum of ulcerative colitis, which is fairly unique and clearly related to the transmural inflammation. To some extent, peroneal disease in some circumstances may also be part of the spectrum of fistulization, but also has to do with a transmural process. And then some of the other features are just, you know, things that are somewhat unique and differentiated. It's not uncommon, even in people with colitis, for them to have rectal sparing as opposed to beginning at the anorectal verge, as it does in UC. It's not at all unusual to have skip lesions where you have an inflamed segment, a normal segment, and an inflamed segment, which is fairly, you know, I don't want to say unheard of, but certainly unusual in ulcerative colitis. And as opposed to UC, where essentially everybody bleeds, about 20 to 30% of patients with Crohn's disease of the colon will not present with gross bleeding. And again, granulomata, which have to do with the nature of the immune response and the type of inflammation, which if you find them are supportive of the diagnosis, but certainly their absence does not exclude the possibility of Crohn's disease. Now again, you talk about the spectrum of Crohn's disease, and probably the most nebulous expression that we sort of see are these punctate superficial erosions, often referred to as aphthous ulcerations. I'll sort of ask, anybody know whether this is small bowel or large bowel and why? Going once, going twice. So, I mean, just if you're ever shown this on like a board question or whatever, you know, the folds of the colon, the haster, are not circumferential folds. The folds of the small bowel, the valvuli condent, they are circumferential folds. So the fact that these are circumferential, they go all the way around the lumen, suggests that this is small bowel, probably ileum, and this is sort of fairly mild inflammation in small bowel representative of Crohn's disease. But this sort of shows you a couple of examples of the spectrum of Crohn's disease. So similar to what I showed you on that colectomy specimen, these are both small bowel resections. Again, the specimens resected, cut open, and laid flat. And so what you see in the panel on the left is, you know, again, here are nice circumferential folds. These are valvuli. This is fairly normal. And when you come down, you have this patch here where you sort of have some erythema. You'll have to trust me that there's sort of an ulcer in here and some thickening. But what's worthwhile noting is that if you basically put a pin here and a pin here, you can almost get this mucosa to lay out flat. Okay, whereas in this case, where you really have this circumferential inflammation, the wall thickness on the left side basically goes from here to about here. And on this end, it's going from here to about here. And when you try to roll this out and leave it open, it basically just keeps rolling back together, because the wall is so thick and tubular and almost fibrotic that it's actually almost impossible to lay this out flat. And so it's not difficult to understand when you're having inflammation like this, how over time it can start off as inflammatory, but you can get a fibrotic response and get stricturing and obstruction. I'll skip this one. But again, well, this is sort of the serosal aspect, and when people refer to the creeping fat, right, everyone's seen a case presentation where a patient comes in with right lower quadrant pain, guarding fever, they go to the OR for what's presumed to be appendicitis, and they suddenly see ileal thickening, and this description of creeping fat, which is sort of this sort of hazy fullness that you can sort of see in the area of the distal ileum and cecum. Here's an example of a granuloma at low power, and here's a blown up view, which again is, you know, suggestive of, but the, you know, I think that most literature will claim you see granuloma in up to 50% of patients with Crohn's disease. And while I believe that's true on surgical resection specimens, it's certainly not true on mucosal biopsies. And you know, we probably see it only on about 10 to 15% of mucosal, not even specimens, but on patients with clear Crohn's disease, finding granuloma on a mucosal biopsy only occurs about 10 to 15% of the time. So its presence is helpful, its absence is certainly not concerning. And again, we talked about it before that there are different clinical patterns of Crohn's disease. What's interesting is that some of these do tend to run in families, so that if the proband tends to have, you know, more of an obstructive type pattern, that's what other family members will have, if it tends to be inflammatory, etc. And one can debate and discuss whether this is really separate entities or separate diseases that we clump together just for the sake of description, or whether they, you know, really are all part of the spectrum of one disease. Okay, and so again, the clinical presentation and the type of symptoms that people have clearly will have an impact based on what their normal pattern is. So people who tend to have an inflammatory pattern, they have a lot of secretion of inflammatory mediators, they have a lot of bowel wall edema, they're losing absorptive surface, and so, you know, they'll tend to have evidence of chronic inflammation, they'll have low-grade fever, they'll tend to have diarrhea, may have some weight loss. It's not unusual to have a little bit of localized pain and tenderness. And you know, these are patients that, depending on the extent, may have elevation of SED rate or CRP, may have thrombocytosis, which is an acute phase reactant. But by and large, will often present with some sort of a chronic inflammatory condition. And contrast that with patients who tend to have more of a fibrostenotic pattern, where what they'll really have is this postprandial distension and cramps. You know, the distension is often intermittent depending on the degree of obstruction, but over time, if you really have a fixed defect, you may end up with vomiting, weight loss, and food avoidance, just because people know that when they eat, they tend to get uncomfortable. Differentiating those two is crucial. And I'll sort of make the point now, because I think that for whatever, you know, people in their mind think and do know about inflammatory bowel disease, I think that one of the classic teachings that we often give, especially to internal medicine house staff, is that, you know, ulcerative colitis at the end of the day may be cured with a colectomy. Crohn's disease can occur anywhere, as we say, from mouth to anus, and often recurs after surgery. And I think many of us go through our training under the impression and with the belief that the most important role that an internist or gastroenterologist can provide to a patient with Crohn's disease is to protect the patient from the surgeon. And I'll sort of make the point in the argument that, you know, one of the most important services that I can provide to a patient who's presenting with pain and distension and intermittent vomiting and weight loss is trying to determine fairly quickly, and quickly isn't, you know, today or in an hour from now, it's usually over a period of days and weeks, whether they have a reversible inflammatory condition or that they have a fibrostenotic obstructive condition. Because no medication in the world will reverse a fibrostenotic stricture. And if you have a patient who's not eating, who's having pain, who's getting distended because they have fibrostenotic Crohn's disease, a nice small ileocolic resection will sort of reset the clock, remove the obstruction, and make them tremendously better. And people don't need to walk around for months or years being told, oh, you don't need surgery because it's not going to cure anything. It's really trying to recognize those patients who really have obstructive symptoms but indeed don't have a reversible component and trying to get them an appropriately timed operation. And this is sort of an example, because I think that the slide on the left is basically just inflammatory. So you have small bowel coming here, terminal ileum feeding into cecum, and it's not that hard to sort of see these lumpy, bumpy areas here, that as opposed to sort of seeing a nice, smooth column of barium here, here you have like all these little chewed out spaces, which is basically ulceration. But, you know, there is a decent caliber to this. You know, barium's getting through pretty easily, and, you know, this is clearly somebody who has an inflammatory process. Now, in this patient here, you sort of see you know, a column of barium coming here. Trust me, this segment is somewhat abnormal. You're sort of losing some folds and some features. But here you barely have this small layer of you know, white barium that's feeding through. And this is the classic string sign that people talk about on small bowel series in people with terminal ileal Crohn's disease. Now, this may just be related to fibrosis, but you can get a response like this even from severe inflammation. So when we see a patient like this who comes in distended, you know, intermittent vomiting, etc., we will often try treating them aggressively with anti-inflammatory medications, even steroids per se. You know, but if they don't open up within a period of days to about a week, then we pretty much know they're not going to open up. And that's somebody who really does much better if you operate on them than if you just keep throwing one medication after another. Again, fistula, you know, can be debilitating. A lot of it has to do with where they are. You know, if they're, they can either go from bowel to bowel or from bowel to other structures. If they go from bowel to bowel, primarily it depends on how much intestine you're bypassing. So if you really had, let's say, a jejunal loop coming around like that, you bypass just a small segment, you know, that's probably asymptomatic. If you had a fistula that was going from the jejunum to the sigmoid colon, and it was providing a path of least resistance, and you were just basically flushing everything through and bypassing most of jejunum, ileum, and right colon, then clearly you're going to have very severe and continuous diarrhea. You know, if you have a communication between the bowel and the bladder, again, the classic symptom of that is referred to as pneumaturia. So you'll ask patients whether they ever sort of feel like they're passing, you know, air, or if they ever see particles when they urinate. And that's certainly, you know, a very suggestive sign of having a communication between the bowel and the bladder. And the most common causes to see that are either Crohn's disease, diverticulitis, or occasionally in patients with malignancy. Again, you can certainly get abscesses between local communication, most common being a psoas abscess, and some of the other types of fistula that we can see here with rectovaginal really being quite debilitating, embarrassing, and uncomfortable. And again, just a couple of examples here where you can sort of see, you know, the barium coming through. You see a nice patent loop from one loop of bowel to another. And here on a resected specimen, you sort of see it comes down and around like that, but that between these two abutting loops of bowel, you have an open communication, you know, which is classic of a Crohn's fistula. And I'll make the point just about perineal disease that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a direct communication. As a matter of fact, where a lot of people with Crohn's disease will have perineal and perianal disease, and it does seem to involve some of the lymphatic drainage and these things that are referred to as cryptium morgagni, but they get partially obstructed because of some of the inflammatory mediators, and you can develop an abscess that over time often drains to the outside as opposed to draining internally. You know, so that said, I think, you know, I've tried to point out why, you know, it's often, again, you can have Crohn's disease of the colon that may be similar to what we see in UC, but more often, you know, we're trying to differentiate between other processes and IBD as opposed to trying to differentiate between UC and Crohn's. And so, you know, classically, we'll see patients with acute onset of bloody diarrhea. They may have traveled, you know, to Mexico or a place where it's more common to get dysentery. And the question is, how do you differentiate between IBD and an acute infection? Well, again, certainly the duration of the symptoms, most infectious illnesses will be acute and self-limited, usually even less than 1 week, certainly less than 2 weeks, whereas IBD may go on, you know, for a longer period of time. The onset is more abrupt with infections. I mentioned that you see some of these other signs of chronic inflammation, so thrombocytosis, elevated sed rate, you know, which, you know, but the thrombocytosis especially is less common in acute infections. Depending on the duration of disease, you may actually already have an anemia of chronic disease. But from our standpoint, some of this abnormal crypt architecture, these branch crypts that I showed you before, even with a more acute presentation, is probably a main way to differentiate between inflammatory bowel disease and acute infections. And again, it really shouldn't be all that difficult to differentiate between IBD and IBS, but bear in mind that IBS is primarily irritable bowel syndrome, is primarily a functional disease, often related to irregular perception and muscle contraction, etc. So, you know, finding clinical signs of inflammation, weight loss, you know, blood, etc., would all be, you know, essentially unheard of in IBS. And again, I think that the one time that this is difficult is when you have people presenting with intermittent diarrhea, lower abdominal cramping, very vague, you know, symptoms, somewhat normal labs, and the question is this all functional, or do they have, let's say, Crohn's disease of the ileum that really, you know, hasn't come to clinical attention yet? But when one tries to differentiate between UC and Crohn's, again, we talked about, you know, being continuous and diffuse as opposed to patchy. We talked about it being mucosal as opposed to transmural. The fact that it always affects the rectum and only involves the colon, and the fact that Crohn's can affect essentially any part of the GI tract. And so this is sort of a nice way to think about differentiating, you know, those subsets of patients of, you know, when we're really confused between whether it's one or whether it's the other. So we said about 80% of patients with Crohn's will have small bowel involvement. You know, if they don't, the differential may still be there. Phrased a different way, essentially all patients with UC will have rectal involvement. especially untreated. If you have a patient who's been on treatment, especially if they're on topical therapy like enema or suppositories, you know, they may have a normal appearing rectum. But for the untreated patient, you know, the rectum should not be spared in ulcerative colitis, so that's a way to help differentiate it. Patients with UC tend to bleed almost always, so absence of bleeding would suggest Crohn's, perineal disease, perianal disease would suggest Crohn's, and then again, when we talked about skip lesions, fistula, granulomata, all of these things should suggest Crohn's, and even with all of that, there are probably about 3 to 5% of patients that still fall into this category of indeterminate colitis, where it's not all that useful, where it's not always simple to differentiate UC from Crohn's. And the only reason I go through that is that some of you have already seen or you've heard about some of the serologies that we use to try to help evaluate patients with IBD. They're not readily available in our lab, and more often than not, they're not necessarily needed. But what's known is that patients who have ulcerative colitis, more often than not, about 60 to 70% of the time, tend to have expression of a antibody called P-ANCA. This is not the same ANCA that you see in, let's say, Wegener's or other autoimmune diseases. It is not a pathogenic antibody. It's not believed that this really has anything to do with the course of the disease, but it's certainly a marker for it. But what's known is that it's present in about 60 to 70% of patients with UC, a much smaller number of patients with Crohn's disease, and probably only about 5% of the general population. Whereas patients with Crohn's disease, about half of the time, will have a different antibody against a common yeast called anti-Saccharomyces cerevisiae antibody, and this is present in less than 5% of UC cases and less than 5% of the general population. The problem with these antibodies and what's worthwhile knowing about them is that, and I'll try to give an example and explain this, that they tend to follow the phenotype, not the genotype. And by that I mean is that if you had a patient, so here's a clinical situation. If you have a patient who has inflammation that starts at the rectum, goes up to the mid-sigmoid, stops abruptly, and has no other evidence of involvement anywhere else in their intestine. Okay, that would sound as though it's proctosigmoiditis, and one would think that because of the continuous involvement, it sounds like UC. Now, if you have biopsies and the biopsies show granulomata, the granulomata would basically make you say, you know what, this is actually Crohn's colitis. Now, if you did serologies on that patient, patients who have limited colitis or colonic involvement only tend to be ANCA positive, ASCA negative, even if they ultimately have Crohn's disease by presence of granulomata, overall over time developing fistula, etc. So when I say that it hasn't solved the problem of indeterminate colitis, if somebody has skip lesions, if somebody has fistula, if somebody has a lot of small bowel involvement, you don't need the serologies. If somebody has some, let's say, proctosigmoiditis that has an abrupt transition, but they almost never tend to bleed, or they have other features that seem atypical, the serologies usually won't help. So what we've tended to do in the limited number of circumstances that we've looked for them, we more often try to do the serologies to differentiate IBD from non-IBD than we do to differentiate Crohn's disease from ulcerative colitis. I'm going to skip through some of these quickly, but you should probably all be aware that there are a whole host of extraintestinal manifestations of inflammatory bowel disease. What's worthwhile noting is that some of them actually parallel the disease activity, so when you're having a flare of your colitis, you're more likely to have them. Others have an independent course. And does anybody know what the hallmark of those that have an independent course are? What serology or what can we look for in patients with some of these manifestations? It's a board question, so I'll, you know, but HLA-B27 is something that's sort of a chronic hallmark among people who have those manifestations that don't relate to disease activity. So again, the arthritis can either, you know, it's usually larger joints more than small, one joint at a time, no nodules, seronegative, and does parallel disease activity, as opposed to the spondylosing arthropathy, the ankylosing spondylitis, which you sort of see here in this bamboo spine, which is not related to disease activity. In this patient, these staples are actually related to a previous colectomy, but you can still have progression and symptoms related to that. Again, when you talk about skin manifestations, these red bumpy lesions, what skin lesion is this? Erythema nodosum, which does usually parallel disease activity. And this is pyoderma gangrenosum, often again anterior shins ulcerating, usually more related to, and actually this is true for all of them. The extra-intestinal manifestations can occur with both UC and Crohn's, but they're usually more common in people who have colitis. It's less common in people who only have small bowel Crohn's disease. Again, with the eye findings, this is episcleritis, anterior uveitis. The way to differentiate which one is which is that the one that looks more red and hot and inflamed is the one that goes along with disease activity. So episcleritis tends to occur more often with disease activity. Anterior uveitis, which is more of a painful condition, occurs independent of that. I'll take 30 seconds just to mention there is indeed an increased incidence of dysplasia and cancer in patients with IBD compared to controls. Usually starts 1 to 2 decades after initial diagnosis. Is believed to be about 0.5% per year. You know, there are things that are somewhat different about it. They can arise in flat mucosa. You can have multiple neoplasms at the same time. It can infiltrate submucosally and broadly, so you don't quite see a mass or a polyp as you do with most colon cancers. And obviously, because this is a disease of younger people and it can start occurring within 10 to 15 years of onset, it usually affects a younger population than we traditionally see. This slide is just here to make the point that there's still some disagreement in the GI community as to whether patients with Crohn's disease of the colon have that same risk. I'll argue by and large that they do, and that however one chooses to do surveillance on patients with UC after a certain duration, they should be doing the same thing with patients with Crohn's disease of the colon. I'll skip over that. So I probably have about, you know, I think I have about 12 minutes left, and I think I have about 12 or 13 minutes worth of talk, but on what I consider to be, you know, sort of a brief discussion on the mucosal immune system, what happens normally, what's probably happening to some extent in IBD, and to some extent helping to target current therapies as well as future therapies. So we mentioned before that, you know, there are a number of things that you need for IBD. It doesn't happen unless you have luminal antigens, and that includes bacteria. It seems to be that there are certain environmental triggers. We talked about, you know, different populations and sanitation conditions and, you know, latitudes and climates as having a role. And while the genetic component is interesting, it's clearly only one factor. And you probably do need multiple hits and multiple factors to get a clinical expression of inflammatory bowel disease. So with that, again, I'll show you the same slide that I showed at the beginning, just as a definition. So a chronic relapsing idiopathic disorder, you know, with inappropriate activation in response to bacteria, environmental factors, and a genetically susceptible host. And like many other things, if you think you have lots of causes or lots of hypotheses, it probably means you don't really know exactly what's causing it. But I think that, you know, what we'll do is we'll touch on some of the mechanisms and you know, at the end of the day, it really is all about a dysregulated immune response. So for generations, people have tried looking at the concept of an infectious cause of IBD. I think that the fact that there were granulomata often made people think that maybe this was some sort of a mycobacterial illness. There is an organism called Mycobacteria paratuberculosis that causes a granulomatous enterocolitis in sheep and cattle. And it's called something called John's disease, and I think that people just always assume that the organism was there, we've just never cultured it. Clearly in this age, with much better culture techniques, we still haven't cultured it, and it seems unlikely that any one specific infection is really causing inflammatory bowel disease, or even any of the individual, again, whether you want to call it inflammatory Crohn's, or, you know, even any of these sub-diseases, it seems unlikely that anyone is specifically infectious. The concept of defective mucosal integrity is an interesting one. And you can sort of think that when you talk about mucus and permeability and restitution and repair, that you can really have a lot of factors affecting that. You can have mucosal injury such as an infection or, let's say, a medication. You can have genetic predisposition to have different viscosity and components of your mucus. So it's clear that can happen on a number of different levels. You know, in this day and age where we're, you know, every time you open any type of medical literature, there are ads for probiotics, and you know, patients are coming in and saying, you know, should I take colon cleansing, and I saw the Dillis and X, Y, and Z, but clearly we have a better understanding of the concept of protective organisms and aggressive organisms, and this may well have something to do with disposition at different environments and climates about what really are the components of your normal gut flora, depending on where you are, and somehow the interplay of all of these, you know, probably affects this loss of tolerance. The fact that your mucosal immune system can no longer downregulate and doesn't help you identify non-self as, you know, as that, and actually causes a much more prolific immune response. So again, genetics are really somewhat fascinating, at least to me. You know, we know that there is a genetic predisposition. Identical twins, you know, one has Crohn's disease, about the odds are about 50-50 that the other sibling will have it. With ulcerative colitis, the risk is only about, you know, 10-15%. Dizygotic twins are siblings. You know, the risk in general is that if there's a first degree relative with IBD, there's about a 5% likelihood that somebody else in the family will have it. So to me, the important component of this slide isn't that there's a strong genetic component because half of monozygotic twins will have Crohn's disease, is that there's so much more than genetics, because only, you know, half of identical twins will have Crohn's, and not even 15% of identical twins will have UC. So while genetics may have a role, it's clear that there are a lot of other factors. And what we know is that it does run in families. I mentioned this before, patterns of Crohn's. So families that have inflammatory disease will tend to have inflammatory fibrostenotic, tend to have fibrostenotic. And over the last decade or so, we've identified a number of genes. This one particular mutation called NOD2, which is present on chromosome 16, and does seem to be linked to families that have fibrostenotic disease. So again, this is another hit, it's another predisposition. In and of itself is not the be-all and end-all. You know, we talked about things that can cause both onset, initial things. So, you know, somehow you initiate inflammation. So whether, you know, it's antibiotics, other medications, diet, NSAIDs, acute infection, once you affect the barrier function and cause some denudation of mucosa, then you theoretically can have an antigen load. And so this is just sort of, I think, a nice slide on normal GI immunity. So this is sort of a nice, you know, mucosal gland, and you basically have the mucosal layer here. You have tight junctions that act as a barrier. You have mucus that's put out that basically also helps to prevent things coming through. There's something called intestinal truefall factor, which has to do with regeneration and repair mechanisms. There are other factors that help you with repair of the mucosal layer. There's secretory IgA, but all of these things are basically designed to allow for controlled uptake of antigens. So this is the luminal layer, antigens coming through. You have these cells called M cells, and in a normal host and under normal circumstances, what you really have is controlled uptake of antigen, where the mucosal immune system and its higher patches are revved up, ready to deal with it. And the type of inflammation that you generate under this controlled circumstance is a downregulation. It's a suppressive immune tone that leads to this induction of tolerance, primarily through anti-inflammatory cytokines, so TGF-beta and IL-10. But clearly, there's more than one way to have inflammation. And while we'd like to go through this downregulated, you know, system, you can clearly have pathways that have, again, towards granulomatous disease, which may be the pathway that we follow in Crohn's disease, you know, other acute inflammatory conditions that are pro-inflammatory. And just when you take a look at some of the cytokines involved here, I mean, TNF, which I think most of you know is a target for therapy, some of the other interleukins, interferon. So some of these, if activated, may actually be what begins this cascade. So it's like anything else you've learned about, you know, immunity in other parts of the body. If you don't have this controlled uptake under normal circumstances, suddenly, or if you have another factor, such as a genetic predisposition so that your mucus is of a certain viscosity that it doesn't act as a barrier in the same way, your tight junctions are more leaky than the average person. Any of these things can give you a leaky mucosal barrier, have you get flooded with antigen in an area where your GI mucosal immune system is not necessarily revved up to handle it, and this can cause this dysregulation of immune response. And really what is referred to as this mediator imbalance between, you know, these suppressive cytokines and some of these inflammatory cytokines. And what's interesting is that, again, this is all data from the last maybe 10 to 15 years, because prior to that we had no animal models for IBD. But now that we have a couple of animal models, it's clear that if you have all of these predispositions, or you have the specimen in a vacuum or in a sterile area without bacteria, you don't induce inflammation. It's only once you reintroduce a mucosal flora and you have bacteria that you do induce inflammation, which has allowed us to basically say, you know, we now know absolutely that the normal flora plays a role in terms of some of the interaction of, if not initiating, certainly propagating and continuing the immune response. And again, just some examples of more of these probiotic or protective or anti-inflammatory commensals and some of the more injurious ones. So if you have a model of IBD, so, you know, we all get exposed to various loads of antigen, again, and it could be an NSAID, which causes local denudation of mucosa, it could be a viral infection, but, you know, you have the normal tone of the gut, which is tolerance and controlled inflammation, some environmental trigger, such as infection, you get an acute injury, and if you have a normal mucosal immune system and you don't have any of these predispositions to have problems with either immune dysregulation or barrier function, etc., you go back to this mode of tolerance, you have complete healing, and you go down a pathway here. If you are somebody who is programmed or predisposed to developing IBD, you often may have, you know, some trigger that affects the regeneration and repair of normal mucosa, and that may start a pathway of inflammation that then propagates and continues in the model of IBD. And I'm going to stop there. Again, for those who are, I think that by and large, most of these patients don't end up in general medical clinic. I think certainly when they're hospitalized, you know, the GI service is often involved from the standpoint of therapy. So the slides are there if anyone, you know, wants to look at an overview of therapy, but I'm not necessarily going to keep you here for that today. And I'll stay around for a few minutes if anyone has any questions. Okay, thank you.
Did I forget to sign?